morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Good morning. It's a Monday, but that's okay. We're going to get you through it. It's 6 minutes past the hour, as mentioned, and good morning to people who are following the political process closely today. Good morning to people using public transportation, people whose cars get 25 miles to the gallon or better, to people who aren't sure where they're going to sleep tonight through no fault of their own, and a special good morning to those making their living off the internet. You know, on Friday, Brendan McDonald, our producer, and I were having a discussion about what we were going to think about doing on Monday morning. And we talked a little bit about these riots that are going on, the violence that's going on in the suburbs of Paris. And we thought to ourselves, well, gee, you know, maybe that won't be that big a story come Monday morning. Boy, was I wrong about that. It's turned out that that violence has escalated not just into Paris, but through cities in and around France as well, to a point now where 3,300 vehicles have been burned. Right now, we're going to find out what is going on. We're going to say a special good morning to a very special guest. He is senior analyst with France 3 TV, Mr. Christian Mallard. Good morning. I guess I should say good afternoon, Christian.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
Fine. Well, the situation is getting worse in this country, and I can't say I'm feeling great about the evolution of the situation, but we have to face it anyway.
Yes. Now, let's talk a little bit about how bad the violence is at this point and why you think it's spreading.
Well, it is true that we have to give this. It's a long-time, deeply rooted problem. And I must admit that all the various governments which have been ruling this country for the last 20 to 25 years have all been failing to find the solutions to this suburbs problem, where we have to face youth gangs, which are French-born people from Arabic origins or African origins. And these people live in very poverty-stricken areas of Paris and the big city suburbs you are alluding to, where the riots have been expanding, as you said rightly. And these people, well, they are young people. Most of them are between 13 and 25. So they have no job, not real education. The parents are not even controlling them. They are in desperate situation, desperate areas. And the only things that they want, that they are, it seems to me right now, they are at war against the French government, against the French state. The other thing I would like to put on, because it's the main reasons why all these people are ransacking shops, police station, railway station, all the kind of things we can think about, and throwing stones like a French intifada, as we could call it. And even, I would say, these people might be one of the next steps I worry about. Lot of these young people, being Muslim, might be, and we know that some of them are, manipulated by Muslim fundamentalist networks.
Now, Christian, we've seen and heard about that, but is it not true that the largest Islamic group in France has issued a fatwa condemning the violence?
Oh, you put, Mark, you just put the right question. The thing is, this, in French we say UOIF, which is the Federation of Islamic Organization Union. These people are belonging to Muslim Brotherhood. They are Muslim fundamentalists, the same people who have been at war against Secretary of Interior Sarkozy a few months ago when he was talking about the religious scarf, the prohibiting of the wearing of the religious scarf in France for Muslim women.
Yeah, that created a lot of controversy in France,
exactly,
didn't it?
Exactly. You are right. You follow the situation very well, Mark. And the thing is, the same people today are saying that the issue of fatwa, which is an indirect acknowledgement of the fact that they exert an influence about part of these youngsters, these Muslim youngsters or youth gangs who have been fighting the French government in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Christian Mallard, I have to ask you about the reports that the violence was initially triggered by the electrocution of two young, I believe it was North African men, who had hidden out in a power station. There was some question as to whether or not they had been chased there by police or held there by police or put in danger by police. Is that a, I mean, is the media in France looking at that as the real reason why this violence has begun to take place?
What I would say, once again, I like the question because you go straight to the point. The thing is, my feeling is there is still a controversy about the truth, the way the two young kids were run after by the police or not. Officially, the prosecutor, the justice prosecutor said no. But at the same time, other sources say yes. So it's a controversy. But let's put it this way. All this has been cooking up for months, for years. And it was just the way it was the ignition of or sparkling the whole situation. It was the pretext that people used to start showing that they were fed up with their situation, with the situation in France, and they were really dissatisfied with the government and they disagree. But at the same time, we have to face to a lot of people who have never been integrated to French society. And this is one of the problems. We all fail in these countries to integrate these people who are French, as I said, but Muslim origins, Arab origins, or African origins. And this is one of the toughest problems, the toughest situation we have ever faced in this country.
Christian Millard, can you explain for our audience that may not know, and for me, because I'm not absolutely certain, you have President Chirac on the one hand, you have Prime Minister Villepin on the other. Which one are the French people looking to for a solution to this, and what solutions are they projecting right now?
Well, tonight at 2 p.m. your time, 8 p.m. French time, Prime Minister de Villepin should address the nation. And I talked to one of his spokesperson about an hour ago, and I said, what are you going to do? And the spokesman said, first, to remind that we are going to be firm. We have to make a law and order respected in French Republic, this secular country, and there is no way we are going to be accepting any blackmail from these people. But at the same time, they are going to try what they call an action plan, to try to put on the track an action plan. According to what I understood, he will propose a lot of steps or measures concerning housing, finding jobs for these people, most of them being unemployed. And I have to say that in all these suburbs where we have the riots, the rate of unemployment goes from 20% to 40%, which is twice to three more bigger than the average rate of unemployment, which is 9.8. So housing, job, education, I would say it's high time we think about that to try to solve the problem. But once more, all left-wing government in the past and this right-wing government have been unable until now to cope with the situation or to find the appropriate solutions to try to cool down the solution. Will de Villepin succeed tonight after he has been talking to the nation on television? Well, we hope, everybody hopes, but it's not sure.
Christian Millard, one final quick question. Thus far, from reports we've seen, no one has died through this now, 9 days of violence. Are you afraid that someone or large numbers of people will be killed if this violence continues?
Yeah, you are right. You are very right, Mark. There is a danger. If such is the case on either our side, if it's any casualties on the rioters in these suburbs or if it's on the police side, we will get trouble. A lot of the people think now, if the situation extends, as you said it very well, to other cities of the country, northwest, east, south, as it is the case, we might have, I don't know, we think that the army may be stepping into the game with installing curfews. It's one of the possibilities if we come from urban guerrilla to a more insurrectional, generalized situation. We are not there yet, but there is a risk. Definitely.
Christian Millard, thank you so much for being with us on Morning's Edition today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Christian Millard, senior analyst with France 3 TV, giving us the latest on what's going on in the violence that is racking France. A lot of stuff going on for a Monday morning, and we're going to get to all of it. There was a freak tornado that cut a huge and devastating swath through Indiana and Kentucky. We'll tell you about that. There's been a bipartisan congressional call for greater limits on the FBI's ability to demand business and personal records. You remember that library story you may have heard of last August where the FBI was demanding records from a library up in Connecticut? That's what this is all about, and you'd be surprised who is on the side of civil liberties. We'll tell you that as well. And there's some local and national races for governor. There's some ballot initiatives. There's redistricting. There's all kinds of stuff going on tomorrow. So get ready if you're living in certain states, and we'll tell you which ones, to turn out and vote. We'll be right back at 16 minutes past the hour. Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Mornings Edition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, it's Mornings Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back tomorrow. That's right, folks. All you conspiracy theorists, everybody who's like, oh, well, it was Maron, he will be back with us live tomorrow. I don't know how many of you on the East Coast may have been up late last night or may have been awakened by a huge clap of thunder and then a whole bunch of rain in the middle of the night. That might well have been the aftermath of this storm, a tornado apparently, that cut a huge and devastating swath through Kentucky and Indiana. At least 22 people have been killed. 200 have been injured. This particular tornado touched down about 2 o'clock in the morning east of Evansville, Indiana, and then ripped through Henderson County, Kentucky. And apparently it really just caught a lot of people completely by surprise. We're talking about a path of destruction that was 3/4 of a mile wide and perhaps as long as 20 miles. And it hit a mobile home park and devastated that. Apparently 15 deaths in one county and another 7 or more in another county. And it looks as though the casualty numbers may go up. They may, in fact, rise. So, again, you know, we've had so many situations. We've had Hurricane Katrina. We've had Hurricane Wilma. We've had Hurricane Rita. And there's no reason, in my judgment, to treat this particular tornado that killed 20-some-odd people, that ripped through a place where they don't normally get hurricanes, by the way. There's no reason to treat this any differently. Those folks are probably going to be crying out for help. Many of them have lost whatever they may have had in life as a result of this tornado. So when people call and ask for help for Indiana and Kentucky, here's hoping that folks will heed that particular call. I was absolutely stunned, as I know Brendan and John and everybody else was, by this bipartisan congressional call for greater limits, restrictions, ladies and gentlemen, on the FBI's ability to demand business and personal records in terror investigations. Now, you know, the Patriot Act kind of expanded the FBI's power to do this sort of thing. And in fact, they send out what are called national security letters. I don't know how many of you may have gotten one in life, but a national security letter essentially says, we want some documents. Actually, not we want, we demand documents from you. The thing is, the FBI doesn't go through a judge to get the order for these documents, nor is there any limit whatsoever on how long these documents may be kept. Last August, as we mentioned before the break, a library in Connecticut had been the target of just such a letter. And here's the catch-22. If you are a target, you cannot publicly disclose that you are a target. That's part of the rule book in all this. Now, you might expect people like Senator Ted Kennedy and others in Congress to call for greater limitations on this. But the thing that really knocked me out this morning was to find out that a person that we've kind of dogged out in the past, Tom Coburn, Senator from Oklahoma, he too is calling for greater restrictions on the FBI. When Tom Coburn says the FBI needs to be reined in, believe me, we live in a very different world than perhaps the one we think. He has called us, and the Bureau, I would think, which of course is holding out for keeping things pretty much the way they are, I think they're in pretty bad trouble when you have this kind of bipartisanship over an issue involving people's right to privacy, because this gets to the core of people's right to privacy. You may remember some time ago, folks laughed when they said, well, you know, the libraries, they might be able to actually demand information from libraries. People thought, what are you, crazy? No one's going to demand any information out of a library. Well, last August, the FBI, in fact, did. And now they're sending out 30,000 of these national security letters each and every year. This is a quantum leap from what they were sending out before September 11th. And I suppose there are some Americans who will argue that that's the justification. That, you know, we live in a different world now. We're susceptible to terrorism. And the FBI should have the right to access these documents and hold on to them as long as they need to in order to achieve or accomplish whatever it is they're looking to do. That may be part of the problem. We don't always know why the FBI snatches these documents. And certainly when it comes to people that are not able to comment publicly about the fact that the FBI has demanded these documents, that is an extremely, I would think, dangerous assault on the freedoms that we have up until now held, I should say, pretty dear. Very quickly, a death row inmate who waltzed out of a Houston jail. I thought Texas kept their death row inmates pretty much under lock and key, didn't they? Well, not this particular guy. Charles Victor Thompson, a convicted double murderer, slipped away from a jail, was busted 3 days later, stinking drunk and on a payphone. And this, by the way, was in Shreveport, Louisiana, some 200 miles away from Houston. It's good the guy got locked up again, but how in the world does a death row inmate escape? Now, he was not, as far as I can tell, I'm not sure that he was on death row, because death row in Texas, I think, is usually in Huntsville. And maybe we'll get some folks on the phone to correct us on that if we're wrong. 866-303-2270 is our number, 866-303-2270. And then you can talk about that. You can talk about what's going on in France. If there are people that know folks who have been devastated by that tornado that unexpectedly ripped through Indiana and Kentucky, 22 people were killed. Give us a call, 866-303-2270. And, of course, the White House, you know, the White House has been doing a lot of strategy work over the last little while, and their latest strategy is a 600-page document on guess who? The guy that may not be filibustered on his way to an associate justice gig in the United States Supreme Court. We'll tell you all about the Alito playbook next here on Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Good morning. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. He'll be back tomorrow. And, you know, one thing I love about our listeners is the very simple fact that you ask a question and you get a definitive answer. We're going to go right now to our telephones. And Al, who's calling us from Dallas, Texas, with some information about that guy, that death row inmate who escaped. Al, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you, Mark?
Good, good. Doing well. So enlighten me. Bring it.
Okay, the deal was this guy, Huntsville is where they have the death row inmates.
Okay.
And, he was going to court at Harris County to meet with his lawyer. And you know how they got those cubicles where you meet with your lawyer or you go to court and they give you a suit to go to court to do these things, right?
Yeah.
Well, somebody let him keep his clothes.
Oh.
And somehow somebody opened the door when he was leaving and somebody slipped him a badge. He walked straight out of the court building.
With a badge?
He had a badge.
Somebody's going to be looking for work down there in Harris County, huh?
You know what I'm saying? The heads are going to roll down here.
All right. Al, listen, man, thanks a lot. There's a comedy of errors if I ever heard one. My goodness.
I'm telling you.
Much appreciated.
Hey, listen, Mark, I love your show. I'm originally from New York City. I'm from Washington Heights.
Oh, okay. I lived up in the Heights myself.
Yeah, from 161 Riverside.
Oh, I used to live 160 in Riverside way back in the day.
Get out of here.
I'm serious, man.
Yeah, so you know about us Dominicans then, huh?
You got that right. I love the Dominican community, though, man. Al, stay well, huh?
You too, man, and I love your guys' show. Tell Mark I said hi.
Will do, man.
He's not going to leave, right?
No. He will be back tomorrow.
Awesome. All right, man. Have a good day.
Thanks a lot for calling.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Wow. So the guy got out with a badge in his hand. Yeah, somebody, there's going to be a bunch of people looking for work. I wouldn't imagine that this might not go to, what are they? They got a corrections commissioner or something there in Texas? My guess is he or she may be looking for work before very long. We do know one thing. After tomorrow, there's going to be at least one candidate in New York City. One candidate, actually more than one candidate in New York City, one candidate in New Jersey, one candidate in Virginia looking for work. And there are going to be some ballot initiatives decided in the state of California that may well be a harbinger of exactly what will happen to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger out there, because apparently he put his rep on the line over some of those ballot initiatives. But the attention of the nation has inexplicably focused on the state of New Jersey, where there's been more mud slung than you can find in the average landfill in America. I mean, folks, this really got ugly. This is the race for governor between John Corzine, who's now a United States senator, and Doug Forrester, who ran for the Senate a couple of years back and did not win and now is running for governor. They had the final debate over the weekend. I actually sat and watched the whole thing. It was gross. It was gross because this particular race has been polluted by all kinds of sexual innuendo, allegations of sexual peccadilloes, the whole nine yards. The latest of which, by the way, now we told you on Friday that Doug Forrester, fired the first shot across the bow by quoting in one of his campaign ads a negative comment by John Corzine's ex-wife about his commitment to family and the possibility that he might disappoint the state of New Jersey the same way he disappointed his family. Then it turns out there was an email that alleged that Doug Forrester had an affair with a former Miss New Jersey who's now a lobbyist. Well, the latest wrinkle in all this is that there's an allegation that a former Corzine staffer with whom he allegedly had an affair had an abortion in the state of Ohio. God, does it get any worse than this when you're running for office? Who would run for office based on this kind of nonsense? Now, what this has done in New Jersey, and I'd be interested to hear from people in the Garden State or from around the country on this. Those of you in New Jersey know, however, that we already have an acting governor, a guy by the name of Dick Cody, who stepped aside, much in the way that Anthony Weiner, who was running for the Democratic nomination for mayor here in New York, stood aside so that Fernando Ferrer could be the Democratic nominee. Well, Dick Cody stood aside the minute John Corzine said he was interested in running for governor. And you know what? Right now, Dick Cody has a higher approval rating than John Corzine or Doug Forrester. He is now seen as a guy, everybody says, gee, you know, I really wish I could vote for Cody. There even are some people in New Jersey who are talking about writing Dick Cody's name in. That's how disgusted they have gotten with the level of mudslinging that is taking place between Corzine and Forrester. John Corzine, during the course of this debate, I have to tell you, simply looked like he was taking a test or something. He must have had notes in front of him, and he never, or very rarely it seemed to me, looked up from his notes. On the other hand, Doug Forrester just looked like he was selling snake oil. He had a totally inadequate, and in my judgment, incompetent response when asked why last week on a Wednesday he said that he would not use John Corzine's ex-wife's statements in a campaign ad and then proceeded to unveil the campaign ad the next day. He didn't come up with a great explanation. It was some gobbledygook about, well, this is about governance. This is, she was speaking to the issue of governments and governance, and that's why I put it in the ad. And, of course, Corzine is seeming to barely dignify any of this with a response. But, God, it is ugly. And, you know, I got to go to the polls tomorrow and cast my ballot. Believe me, folks, I'll do the right thing. But, you know, there is that temptation to just, like, snatch a pen and write Dick Cody in the write-in section because this has just gotten so, so ugly. Obviously, we're now about less than 24 hours from the polls actually opening. in the state of New Jersey. And hopefully voters will not be as disgusted as an awful lot of people I've been talking to over the weekend who are talking about staying home. Of course, it's the home stretch of the New York City mayoral race as well. Fernando Ferrer, the Democratic nominee, who's not given a ghost of a chance at this point against incumbent Mike Bloomberg, was out and about. I actually attended a function up in the Bronx that I was invited to through my son, believe it or not. And it was a very interesting event. Senator Hillary Clinton spoke there. Fernando Ferrer spoke there, and it was a bunch of very enthused Bronx Democrats. Now, for those of you who have never been to New York, the Bronx is one of New York City's five boroughs. It is Fernando Ferrer's home borough, and recent polls have said that Fernando Ferrer will not even win the Bronx. I think those polls are probably way, way off. He's going to win the Bronx. He's going to win the Latino community. Anything else is going to be gravy at this point, and it really does all center around the question of turnout. In Virginia, there is a very, very close gubernatorial race. And in that instance, you're talking about the Democratic nominee, Mr. Kane, and the Republican nominee, Mr. Kilgore, in a race that apparently the pollsters are saying is too close to call. And, of course, you know, the pollsters have kind of dominated this little truncated election season. There's not a lot of stuff going on, but, you know, the pollsters are making a fortune just predicting how these votes are going to go. There have been no fewer than 10 polls in New York City that say that Mike Bloomberg will win the mayoralty, win re-election by no less than 25%, which is, in my estimation, way too high, but we'll see what happens tomorrow. The main thing is I hope that people do not get too turned off or think that whoever has been projected in the polls is the inevitable winner of an election. To me, that's one of the more dangerous aspects of contemporary politics, is the notion that the polls end up telling you who's going to win so people don't think they have to bother. Well, folks, if you don't bother, then the polls, A, might get proven completely wrong, but B, you do hold open the possibility that the kind of sleaze that we've seen, not so much in New York. New York has not been a sleazy mayoral campaign. In fact, I was talking to some people about that the other day. They're saying, you know, for all the back and forth and the this and that in New York, it really has not become a sleazy race. But believe me, folks, in Jersey, it has. And, you know, there can be some permanent and very profound ramifications when you have people slinging mud at this level, you know, abortions and, you know, mistresses and I mean, it is just too sleazy to contemplate. Although, you know, it may well be that as people say it's sleazy, they change the way they're going to vote because one of those arguments, one of those reports, even one of those things that people said was completely untrue, it may end up sticking in someone's mind enough to make them change their vote. Now, I'm not certain it's going to happen that way, but you never know. In Detroit, a mayoral election is taking place, and in that instance, a former candidate for mayor, Mr. Hendricks, is running against the incumbent, Mr. Kilpatrick, who had a reputation as being the nation's hip-hop mayor. Apparently, the guy had an earring in his ear. Young guy, as a matter of fact. His mother, I believe, is a congresswoman from Detroit. And he has been one of these people who has gotten, at least some people around him, have gotten caught up in a couple of corruption situations. And, of course, the unemployment rate in Detroit is almost as high as the unemployment rate in the suburbs of Paris. Knock wood, Detroit has not exploded the way Paris has. But, you know, you're talking in Detroit of an unemployment rate that hovers between 15 and 20%. The automobile business, folks, in case you haven't noticed, isn't doing that well. And when the automobile business does not do well, Detroit as a city does not do well. And Detroit hasn't been doing great for the last three or four decades. In fact, since the violence of the late 1960s, we've seen a systematic drain of resources out of the city of Detroit. And we've seen a succession of mayors, most notably the late Coleman Young, try and deal with that situation. But right now, it's between Hendricks and Kilpatrick in the city of Detroit. And so we've got, and of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger has staked his rep I believe it was 8 ballot initiatives, many of which would deal with issues like teacher tenure, the power of unions in the state of California, some redistricting, which is also, by the way, going on in the state of Ohio. I don't know how they can conduct this, an election in the state of Ohio without getting those voting machines seriously looked at, because there have been questions about them, certainly after last year's elections. And I don't know for a fact that they are using different machines than the ones they used last year. Here in New York, of course, we don't have to worry about that. Our machines go back to 1962, as a matter of fact. And every time they try and get new ones, somebody files a lawsuit, and that's the end of that. So we have 43-year-old machines here in New York. And I guess they work okay. I don't know anybody's been accused of throwing an election or having an election jobbed here in New York, although there were some questions about how people might have been able to run the tally numbers in the bottom corner of the machines. But, hey, we've got an election tomorrow here in New York, over in New Jersey, in Virginia, in Detroit, in Ohio, in California. If you're in any of those states, if you know anybody in any of those states, please get them out to the polls. Your franchise is crucial. We're going to come back, talk about some more things, like, for example, Alito, which we mentioned a little bit earlier. We're going to be talking about the Republican Party playbook to get Samuel Alito Jr. on the U.S. Supreme Court. Talk a little bit about Terrell Owens. You may not know who he is, a football player. Although, not last night he wasn't. He was suspended. We'll tell you why, and we'll tell you how it turned out for his team when we come back here on Air America Radio. It's Morning Sedition, 47 minutes past the hour.
Hi, this is Phil Lesh from the Grateful Dead. One time, I was listening to Morning Sedition, and Maron started riffing on the Bush administration. Then Riley came in with a slamming groove about the right wing's use of the media. Just when you thought it couldn't get any freakier, Maron broke into Scarlet Begonias. What a sick jam. Best show ever. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Architect Karl Rove.
Fifty-two minutes past the hour. That may be the last time anyone cheers at the sound of that name. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron's off. He will be back tomorrow. And there are published reports this week that say that some people around Karl Rove are actually preparing for his imminent exit from the White House. Not just his exit. There's talk, and again, this falls into the general realm of speculation, which, by the way, we're going to give you the opportunity to do later on this morning, all right? We're going to let you be the pundit in our next hour, but be that as it may, there is increasing speculation that numbers of Bush appointees, numbers of his closest inner circle, will be heading out the door over the next year. And they're looking at Karl Rove as being the first one of them. He may have been the architect after last year's election, but at this point he could end up being the indictee, because Patrick Fitzgerald, despite all of Karl Rove's protestations to the contrary, isn't finished with the architect just yet. He's trying to find out whether or not Rove lied to the grand jury, lied to the prosecutor about exactly where he got Valerie Plame's name and who he gave it to. He's on the record as saying he got it from reporters. That seems to be what everybody says. Well, I got it from reporters. I got it from this one. I got it from that. Well, some of the very people that both Karl Rove and Scooter Libby have alleged they found out about Valerie Plame from have said, no, they didn't find out from us. We found out more or less from that. Matthew Cooper in Time Magazine says he found out about Valerie Plame specifically from Karl Rove. So I'm not sure exactly how much wiggle room the guy has, but it looks as though some of his friends, not his enemies, by the way, not the people in the White House that might have wanted to see him go anyway, some of his friends are preparing for life without Karl. Let's hope one of those friends is President George W. Bush, who didn't exactly have a victory tour going through South America over this past weekend, now did he? He goes down to Argentina, and what happens? Hugo Chavez, who's not even from Argentina, manages to get 25,000 people into a stadium to oppose, guess who? George W. Bush. And, of course, Bush responds saying, you know, you can either go one of two ways. You can go my way or you can go the way of this sociopathic dictator, Hugo Chavez. And, of course, that ignores the fact that Hugo Chavez is an elected head of state. I emphasize elected. America cannot, whether it's in Venezuela or in Iraq, when you say you are pro-democracy, you can't say you're in favor of it only when the people who are elected agree with you. It's not about that. You really kind of have to sit down with people and try and get them to see your way of doing things. And South America is one of those places. We don't hear about it a whole lot. We don't hear read reports about it. But they've been festering about George W. Bush for a long time, about a combination of issues that include but are not limited to Iraq, free trade, and a host, and by the way, America's treatment of Venezuela. Now, some of what Hugo Chavez says, some, is hot air, okay? The whole idea that America's got troops ready to invade, I'm not so certain at this point. But the fundamental premise, and this is, go back and look it up, the fundamental premise that the United States was prepared to back the people who were going to institute a coup against Chavez's government. That is fact, okay? It is also fact that the United States announced the coup before it even started, okay, and thought it was going to be successful, believed that the referendum that the coup apparently engendered against Chavez, the referendum on his presidency, that he would end up losing, and of course he did not. He won. He won about as easily as he won the presidency in the first place. You cannot dictate to people how democracy is supposed to work. And there are numbers of governments, including, by the way, the government of Brazil, which is caught up in a bit of a corruption scandal, but still has cut its own left-of-center path in the world. These governments are not going to sit back and suddenly get stunned into compliance with George W. Bush's agenda. It's not in the cards. It is not going to happen. We were going to talk briefly about T.O., Terrell Owens, receiver extraordinaire. I'll tell you what, though, I'm sick of Terrell Owens, all right? He's the receiver for the Philadelphia Eagles. He is a great player, but he seems never to be able to get along with the people he plays with, whether it's Jeff Garcia when he was in San Francisco as quarterback, or whether it's now Donovan McNabb in Philadelphia. They brought him there. He's been unhappy with his contract for some time, and he's just been ragging on everybody and actually got in a fist fight with former Eagle Hugh Douglas, who's like an icon in the city of Philadelphia. And Terrell got suspended. When he comes back, nobody knows. But we do know what happened to the Philadelphia Eagles last night. They lost to the Washington Redskins, who had, by the way, just a week before, gotten drilled by the New York Football Giants.
Eagles last place in the division.
That's right.
So sweet.
Eagles last place in the division. We got a whole lot more stuff for you. We're going to talk about Samuel Alito and the mainstreaming of a Supreme Court justice with 600 pages of junk next here on Air America Radio's Morning Edition. It's 57 past the hour.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and it's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with us tomorrow live right in this studio. Let's say a special good morning to people going out on job interviews today. Good luck. Good morning to people whose day will be spent in front of a computer screen. Good morning to those who fix those computers when they're broken. And a special good morning to fans of hip-hop, to fans of rock and roll, and a special good morning to fans of classical music. And I know there's some of you out there as well. Lots of things going on in our world. If you're just waking up, there is violence, not just on the streets of suburban Paris, but in cities across France. This violence, which, to be honest with you, I thought would have spent itself by the end of the weekend, seems to be expanding. In our last hour, we had a chance to speak to Christian Millard, who is a senior analyst with France 3 TV, about how things are going inside the country, and it looks as though the spreading violence could well mean calling out the French military. Let's go to a clip from Christian about the possibility of the military on the streets of French cities.
A lot of the people think now, if the situation extends, as you said it very well, to other cities of the country, north, west, east, south, as it is the case, the army may be stepping into the game with installing curfews. It's one of the possibilities if we come from urban guerrilla to a more insurrectional, generalized situation. We are not there yet, but there is a risk.
That is Christian Millard from France 3 TV. And the, I guess, troubling thing for French authorities about this violence is that it appears to have no single leader. It seems to have no one person or group of people that is directing the activity. It seems to be virtually a random insurrection. And it's interesting that we've seen in American cities when there was violence associated with some of the free trade initiatives and meetings that took place in Seattle and then in Canada and other places, it was also this kind of spontaneous and I guess from a government point of view anarchistic violence because see when you have a visible leadership, when you have a group of people, you have a group of folks that you can negotiate with, or a group of people the government can incarcerate. When you have this kind of random violence, and knock wood, no one has died yet, when you start bringing the army, when you start bringing pressure down, it's entirely possible. 3,300 vehicles have been burned in this now more than a week old violence across France. Bunch of other things going on. Of course, there was a tornado that touched down overnight in Indiana and Kentucky. Almost at this point, at least 22 people have been killed. 200 people have been injured. This tornado at its apex was 3/4 of a mile wide and 20 miles long. And it devastated a section of Kentucky and Indiana during a time when most people were totally asleep and not expecting any kind of violent weather outburst. So again, if we hear from people who may need help in Indiana and Kentucky, please answer that call because, you know, they're Americans too and they could use our help, that's for sure. Just like the people that were devastated by Katrina, just like the people that were devastated by Rita. So, Alito, maybe you've heard him not so much in the news over the last few days. Well, Samuel Alito now has a playbook, just like an NFL football team has a playbook. The Republicans have put out a briefing book, a voluminous briefing book for Republican senators. These are talking points and explanations for Samuel Alito. What they're trying to do is mainstream the guy, try to make it look like some of his more activist rulings. And I'm using the word activist very deliberately here, because we're talking about a situation where many conservatives accuse judges on the on various courts as being activist judges, judges who are looking to make policy. Well, Samuel Alito certainly made some rulings, for example, on abortion, on discrimination, and other kinds of issues like that, that might give folks who were hearing his confirmation some pause about exactly where he's coming from. Specifically, that dissent in the 1991 abortion ruling, the whole issue of having to have a husband's consent before a woman could have an abortion. Now they're saying that that ruling, according to the playbook, showed concern for the safety of women. Brendan McDonald, can you explain that to me? What?
I know, I'm dumbfounded.
So am I. I mean, what are they saying? They're saving women from what, beatdowns or something? What are they? I don't understand.
Just the idea that they would put that sentence as the defense is just inherently misogynistic and anti-woman. That you need a man to protect a woman from herself.
That's
crazy.
That is a truly scary part of this plan. And again, this is 600 pages. They distributed this research within hours of Alito's nomination on October 31st, which is, it's only been a week this guy's been around? Wow. At any rate, you have people now saying, including Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, a Democrat, that there probably will not be a filibuster. There will be a straight up and down vote on Samuel Alito's nomination to the United States Supreme Court. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but if you watch any kind of Sunday morning television, if you watch any kind of news across a cycle or two, you realize that there are a lot of folks that make great money speculating about whether or not a guy like Samuel Alito will, in fact, be confirmed. Now, will be confirmed is a separate issue than should be confirmed, because there are a lot of people who are going to say, certainly a lot of people who listen to Air America Radio, who are going to say, well, wait a minute, there's no way the man should be confirmed. And I actually am in full agreement with you. But what I'm questioning is whether or not he will be confirmed. Will the Democrats, in fact, roll over on Samuel Alito and, in fact, roll over on Roe versus Wade? Because that's, in fact, what they're doing. I saw, for example, Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter, on television over the weekend, talking specifically about, in some fairly negative terms, about Roe v. Wade. We reported last week on a story where there are some Democrats who are saying it is now time to give up Roe v. Wade. A ruling, by the way, that a majority of Americans, if you believe the polls, support. So I don't know. I never have been quite sure exactly where people were coming from with this let's abandon Roe v. Wade. But let's put you, our listeners, in the position of pundits for the morning. 866-303-2270 is our phone number. 866-303-2270. Do you think Samuel Alito will be confirmed as an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court? Not whether he should be. I'm sure you got plenty of opinions about whether or not he should be confirmed. I want to find out whether or not you think at this particular point in time that he will be confirmed. What we have seen are activist groups, activist progressive groups trying to organize to oppose Samuel Alito's nomination. But we don't see the same kind of organization on the part of our elected leadership. The people in Congress are not organizing to stop Samuel Alito. Some people think they ought to be. I want to find out whether or not you think this guy is in fact going to get confirmed. And, you know, if you have a minute, maybe talk about what that's going to mean to the rest of us. For men, you know, obviously, we don't have kids, okay? We may impregnate women, but we do not have children. We do not go through childbirth in this society. And to some extent, I wonder sometimes whether or not that disqualifies us in kind of determining the fate of those who do bear children in the world, who do bear that particular weight. That, I think, was one of the things that really was galling about Alito's ruling. The idea that you have to get clearance from a man before you can decide what to do with your own body, which I would assume would be something that would fall within the general rights of privacy. If there is anything that might save Roe v. Wade, it's the issue of privacy, because that's certainly what senators that we were discussing last hour, the people that have now come together in Congress to say that the FBI has gone too far in demanding information from places like libraries, that is a privacy issue. So maybe Roe v. Wade ought to be a privacy issue as well. 866-303-2270. Will Samuel Alito be confirmed as an Associate Justice to the U.S. Supreme Court? We're going to let you play pundit coming up next here on Air America Radio's 15 minutes past the hour, Morning Sedition.
Join the Morning Sedition
right now.
Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Minutes past the hour. Good morning to all. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with us live in studio tomorrow. Coming up, a taped interview that Mark and I did with Dr. Mary Frances Berry, author and former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. We're asking you to play pundit on our telephones at 866-303-2270. Do you think Samuel Alito will be confirmed as an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court? Let's go to our phones and say good morning to Ross, who's calling us from Louisiana. Ross, how you doing?
Doing well.
Good.
Alito's absolutely going to be confirmed. It's not an option.
Not an option. Why?
Well, because you don't have enough votes to stop it without a filibuster, and a filibuster against this guy is not a good idea.
Why not?
because if you filibuster, it's an unwinnable fight. The simple fact is, they break the filibuster. You don't have a filibuster rule anymore. You got three more years of that. This is not a winnable fight. And what I think is worse is guys like you who are articulate guys lying about this guy's record.
What part of his record have I lied about?
You have said twice in the last 20 minutes that the opinion that he gave would require that the husbands approve of the abortions. Absolutely untrue. All it did was say that the husbands had to be notified. Didn't care what they said. I think you tell the truth about the guy. You get the truth out there. If you can't...
Wait. Hold up. Hold up for a second, Ross. Notified, what does that mean?
All notified means is they have to be made aware of. Have you read the opinion?
Yeah, I have. And I've also read the opinion of Bray versus Marriott. You read that one?
No, I have not.
Okay, that's the other one. That's the one where the woman sued based on race discrimination, and he ruled against her. I read that one. And believe me, that one, I didn't distort his record on that.
But you did distort his record on this.
Okay, all right. Let's say for the sake of argument, it is notification and not permission. What's the difference?
The difference is it doesn't require anything. She sends him a letter. She says, "Hey, I'm going to have an abortion."
Why should she have to?
Agree with it.
Explain to me why she should have to.
I don't believe she should have to.
Ah, okay.
You lying about it makes you look bad.
Oh, I'm not lying about it.
You're straight
it's
up
not about
lying.
No. I didn't straight up lie. I said that, and I thought I said
you
notification.
Said, and I quote,
but all right,
you said.
Wait. Well, hold up. Let's talk a little bit about Bray versus Marriott.
Let's not
because
is that not part of his record?
Ross, hey Ross,
said,
is
no.
that part of his record?
It absolutely
it is.
It is
part of
now,
his record.
Why
okay.
Trying to get off of what you said.
Huh? I don't
You're
remember saying that it required. All I said was that it was. All I said that was that it required notification. That's
no,
what
sir,
I said.
No, you did not. That's another lie, and that's.
No, that's not a lie. Look,
look,
Ross. Let me explain something to you. Let's look at his entire record. All right, let's look at all of the rulings that we have had available to us up until now. Let's say for the sake of argument, you're right, that it is only about notification. I and you admit that that wasn't a smart ruling to make. In fact, he was in the minority, was he not?
Absolutely. And
okay.
Incorrect. I'm not disputing that.
All right, so that's my. That is why.
It.
Then let's say I misspoke. And let's say I said requirement and not notification. The fact is he was wrong, right?
I don't dispute that.
Okay, that's all I'm saying. And then if we look at the other parts of his record, if we look at Bray versus Marriott,
we don't enhance our cause.
Hey, Ross, you have not looked at his entire record, obviously. Otherwise, you'd know about Bray versus Marriott, wouldn't you?
But you didn't bring up Bray versus.
Yes,
Marriott.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I did it three different times. I did it twice last week. I did it once this morning. Yes, I did. I did not only bring up the abortion ruling.
You know what? You just need to be a little more honest with yourself.
No. I'm being honest. You need to be honest. You didn't hear the part about Bray versus Marriott, but I said it. Let's be honest about that, Ross.
No, I did not hear
okay.
it.
Okay. All right.
All
that doesn't mean I didn't say it. Thanks a lot for calling. Much appreciated. I like haters. I like people that I like to argue with. I've been an arguer since I was a kid. And maybe I did, in fact, misspeak and say that it was a requirement. It does not change the fundamental fact that the guy was wrong. He was wrong in terms of the ruling he made, and he was outvoted. It was three people. The other two judges on that panel voted against him in that instance. Let's go to another call. Let's go to Susan, who's calling us from California. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I wanted to talk in regards to this Roe versus Wade. I ask everyone, please do not let this gentleman change that state. And the reason why is I'm now 52, but I was 16, almost 17, having my abortion. And the reason why is I had to do it. I could not tell my parents, and I was almost 17, because both my mother and father would have beaten me. They'd done it before. They would have done it again. I had no choice. I had no outlet. And if you take this away from women, there's women who are going to get beaten, and it will be their fault, whoever voted for this gentleman.
Now, you're talking about something. Let's be clear about this, Susan. You're talking about something slightly different than spousal notification. You are talking about parental notification.
Well, it's parental notification. It is parental. It's also in regards to spousal, because the thing is, I would have been beaten by a man, because I have gotten into that situation when I was younger, that even if anything of that thing would have happened, and I would have told my husband, I would have been beaten with that. Because at that period, it was a beaten cycle. And unfortunately, my parents, both my mother and my father, that situation, I had no choice.
They were vehemently anti-abortion, in other words.
Totally. Mm-hmm. And there was no support system. You know, they always say one thing, oh, yeah, don't have an abortion, the whole bit. But it happens. And then where are the children going to go to? And then if it's a young child who is married, you know, young marriage, and has a violent husband, she's going to get beaten. This is appalling.
Well, you know what, Susan? I don't think you're alone in expressing that concern. I've heard this from other women before. I don't know if it's a majority, but I'll tell you what. Thank you very much for the call. We have some other folks who are holding on. Stay with us. We're going to get to you on the telephones. Any other haters out there like Ross in Louisiana, give us a call, 866-303-2270. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Good morning to everyone just waking up this morning. And hopefully you don't have to be to work by 8 o'clock Eastern time, because if you do, you might just be a little late. Coming up momentarily, Mark and I had a very fascinating conversation with Dr. Mary Frances Berry, author and former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. Right now we're talking to you, asking you to be the pundit. Do you think Samuel Alito will be confirmed as a justice to the United States Supreme Court? Let us go next to Robin, who's calling us from Austin, Texas. Robin, good morning. How you doing?
I'm good.
Good. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think that he is definitely going to be confirmed, because the Democrats, unfortunately, we have sided with them on issues we have no business siding with them on.
Such as?
Bankruptcy law. They didn't even need our help to get it passed, but they voted for it.
Yeah, that's true. You know, that's an interesting point. They didn't need us, but we did anyway, huh?
I'm sorry?
In other words, they didn't need us, but we did anyway.
And they do it repeatedly. It's like, do you realize that the people who put you in office don't want you doing this? You know, it's just crazy. But, yes, I definitely think that they are going to. Now, and take this from somebody. I am from New York also originally, and I now live in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I guess it's still supposed to be liberal, but I don't really.
Supposed to be an oasis out there in Texas, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what they say. I had an abortion years ago, and I don't think that anybody gets up in the morning and says, you know, I'm going to go have an abortion, like it's a spring cleaning.
You know, I've said that over and over again.
It's something that is a very difficult decision to make.
Yeah.
And it's not one that you forget about as soon as you walk out of the office. It is something that is with you. I think about that almost on a daily basis, you know.
And how long ago was it, Robin, if I can ask?
About 27 years ago.
27 years ago, and it's still with you today?
Most definitely. And I still say that it is every woman's right to choose what it is that she wants to do or needs to do. And there
important
shouldn't
point.
Be any man standing in anybody's way. It's like going back to the 1800s. You know, what's next? Do they then decide that we don't have a right to vote again?
But Robin, what would be wrong about just dropping the husband, the baby's father, whatever, a note and saying, I'm about to have an abortion? Is that a problem for you?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Most definitely.
All right, just checking. Just want to find out, you know, because
yeah.
Ross in Louisiana said that, you know.
I've been in that situation. I can tell you what was told to me. I had $225 shoved in my face and said, get rid of it.
Ah.
Okay?
Yeah. I understand.
Which was something that I was kind of toying with anyway, but mine was, you know, not so much a matter of, you know, it's going to screw up my life, this, that, or the other thing, more of just a fear of actually having to go through labor.
I understand. Robin, got to run, but thank you so much.
Very welcome.
You take care. We're now going to go to Lee, who's calling us from Indiana. He has some information on that tornado that devastated both Indiana and Kentucky. Lee, good morning.
Hello there, Mark. How are you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Oh, we survived, just barely. Just to give you a little bit of background, I actually live a little bit outside of Evansville, Indiana, in a town called Dale. And like all other working stiffs out there, I hold down two jobs. One of them, which is a night clerk at a hotel. And so we actually went through the tornado with all our residents and everything in there. A tornado is really a different creature than a hurricane. With a hurricane, you have your devastation really primarily with the water and
yes.
the aftermath. With the tornado, it is so intense but very, very small that it literally will come out of nowhere. And unfortunately, because this was at 2 o'clock in the morning at our local time here, that everyone was in bed. I tried to call as many people as I could to warn people, but at the same time, some of these automatic radios that give you weather alerts,
right.
half of those were not working because the system was not working correctly.
Oh, my God. No one was hurt? I hope no one was hurt at your hotel.
No, not at the hotel, thank goodness. Not only was I alert to it, but thank God that the tornado actually lifted up just 5 miles short of us. But still, there was a lot of devastation, even though the tornado didn't hit us. We literally saw horizontal rain.
Really?
The wind speeds were 150 miles an hour.
Oh, my God. That's some scary stuff.
And, I mean, that's like an F3 category hurricane, literally. But the thing is, on this, because with a hurricane, there's a slow buildup. And the couple damage that you can occur with a tornado with the wind is not only the wind itself, but the pressure drop. I've literally seen houses explode. We've drove by today and saw houses that looked like kind of like Barbie doll houses where all the furniture was in place, but a whole side of the wall was gone.
Oh, my God. Lee, you're talking about a really devastating situation. Hopefully, when people are asked to respond with their dollars, with their donations to help people who were devastated by this tornado, they will do so. Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You take care. Wow. I heard a big thunderclap in the middle of the night here on the East Coast and you know, heard rain falling really hard. We were fortunate. We didn't have anything like a tornado. And I can't imagine what it must be like to have to live through one. About a week ago, Mark Maron and I had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She was in town to discuss her book, My Face is Black is True, Callie House and the Struggle for Ex-Slave Reparations. But we also talked to her about her tenure as chairperson of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and why President Bush pushed her out of that job. She's a fascinating person, and we're pleased to play that interview for you right now.
Our next guest was ousted as chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission by the Bush administration almost 1 year ago, apparently for working too hard to stand up for civil rights. She's also the author of My Face is Black is True, Callie House and the Struggle for Ex-Slave Reparations, which came out this summer. Joining us in studio is Dr. Mary Frances Berry. Good morning, Dr. Berry. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
It's great that you're here. So let's just start right out of the gate. Why did George W. Bush get rid of you as head of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission?
Well, we did a report analyzing his administration, and the report showed that his administration basically sucked.
Yeah.
And that
he claims how you really feel.
And that he hadn't done anything on civil rights, and that he needed to make improvements and show some leadership and step up to the plate. And he was very offended by our having the temerity to do this, although we had written reports about other administrations, including Bill Clinton's and other people, and said what they did good and what they did bad. And so he decided that your term's supposed to be up in January after the, you know, inauguration, which we thought would have been John Kerry, but it wasn't.
Right.
But now you should leave right now because, you know, you did this dastardly thing.
You told the truth.
Yeah, you told the truth, and your term is up. So I said, you know, forget it. I'm not paying any attention to you. And I stayed anyway, and then after about 2 weeks after I made my point, I resigned.
Okay.
Now, this wasn't the first time, though, that an American president went after you on the U.S. Civil Rights
Absolutely.
Commission.
Ronald Reagan, Mr. Reagan, the great American president, according to a lot of people, the best American president.
One of the best people ever, according
right,
to some
right.
people.
He did that in the 80s when he said, he told the press that I served at his pleasure and I wasn't giving him any pleasure.
Oh, my God.
Because I criticized his civil rights policy. But I sued him, and the federal district court agreed to me that with me that you can't fire a watchdog for biting you.
Oh,
that's a good point.
So now, but George Bush makes these overtures that, you know, he's a great friend to African-Americans here in this country, that there are many who are Republicans, which I find unbelievable, and that he's obviously living in a dream world.
Well, he obviously is. He's appointed a number of African-Americans to positions. You know, let's say he's done that. He has done the right thing. If you think what happened in Katrina is the right thing, with what happened to the people who were there, but he says he's a compassionate conservative. He doesn't follow through on what he says. Rhetoric is easy.
Mm. Dr. Berry, your book is called My Face is Black is True. This is chronicles the story of a woman named Callie House, who I had no idea
existed.
Yeah, who sought reparations, pensions for ex-slaves during probably the worst period in American history for African Americans outside of slavery. But I wonder, do you see a tie between her call for pensions for ex-slaves and the current call for reparations?
Yeah. She did this in 1897, and it's an untold story, and she was a heroine who has been overlooked in American life, and in many ways was analogous to a woman who we talked about who died, Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks.
Mm-hmm. Passed. They both were people from working class circumstances. Callie House was a washerwoman and a seamstress. Rosa Parks was
a seamstress. Yeah.
And they both came out from obscurity to prominence in a movement. And Callie House, in 1897, led the largest poor people's movement that had existed. 300,000 poor black ex-slaves joined her movement.
300,000?
Yes, and lots of white people, lawyers and other people, tried to help them in this movement. And the idea was that people who were old and sick and who had been slaves, and she had been a slave herself, ought to be given pensions, because at that time, if you had been a Union veteran and had served one day, you could get a pension. And she said, why can't you give us, you know, something for the slave? $12 a month if you're over age 80.
And there were a lot of slaves who had fought for the Union and hadn't gotten paid anything.
Right, and said they didn't have enough documentation. I talk about the story of one of the guys in the book, and he joined this movement because he said, well, since they won't give me a pension, if they give everybody one, maybe I can get one. But the connection between that movement, which was suppressed by the federal government as being something that was too activist and radical, and today, is that they had chapters anywhere any black people lived, and the poor people would put their nickels and dimes together and do what they called in those days mutual assistance. Immigrant groups did it too, burying people, getting doctors if they were sick, medicine and so on, taking care of widows and orphans. And these chapters continue to exist after this movement went out of existence. And the chapters you can trace all the way back from then all the way up to now.
Are they in the same, what is the organization that they operate under?
Well,
now?
The chapters, some of them evolved in the 20s to Marcus Garvey's movement when he came to the
Universal
United
Negro
States.
Improvement.
Right. UNIA chapters. I found some of the same people as agents, as chapter heads who were there. And then they evolved into the Muslims, to Malcolm X, to some of the poor people's movements in the South and places like Louisiana. Some of those people you saw in Katrina are descendants.
Oh,
of these people who've been down there in the South since those days. And the modern day reparations movement, many of the people who are in it came in it through a woman named Queen Mother Moore.
Oh,
Audrey
absolutely.
Moore.
Sure.
And Audrey Moore came out of the New Orleans chapter of the Marcus Garvey movement, which had been an ex-slave pension movement chapter.
Well, it's very interesting because
that is fantastic. I didn't know that.
Historically speaking, we talked to what was Malik Rahim the other day, who started referring to the governmental structure of Louisiana as the plantation syndicate.
Yes,
that it's still in existence, that type of dynamic.
Right, absolutely. And so the difference, though, is today people who argue for reparations, and you don't have to be for or against reparations to read this book. I mean, the book is not a case for one way or the other. It's a story of this movement and tracing it to today. But today people are arguing when they're no longer ex-slaves alive. Callie House was making an argument for people who had actually been slaves,
still
she herself were slave, were alive. There was no Social Security then. That didn't come to FDR. And she's saying these people are old and sick and poor, and can't we, you know, get some kind of help from the government? I mean, even conservatives who are against reparations feel that there is a certain poignancy to the claims that these people made.
Now, I have to ask you this. What do you think of your successor on the commission, Gerald Reynolds?
Well, I don't know the man. I know his record, and I do know that he told the public that he didn't think, he wasn't sure there were any civil rights issues, and that he would have to figure out whether there were some and whether there was any discrimination. Maybe he's figuring that out.
Still, but wait a minute. He's on a commission that is called the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. That's like being in the Department of Defense and not thinking you need any tanks.
Right.
It?
And so I'm hoping that he's figuring that out. The only report I've seen that they've done is one where they tried to trash Clinton's Mend It, Don't End It on affirmative action, which saved it, and it was working. And we were doing a report on it, and they tried to come out and say, well, oh, no, 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 you need race-neutral programs, and this doesn't work. But I haven't seen anything. I haven't heard anything from them about Katrina or about any of the issues. But he's probably still trying to figure out whether there are any civil rights issues. And when he figures it out, I'm sure he will tell us.
Well, I would hope that he would figure it out, given that he is the
maybe
guy.
Maybe he'll come here and tell us.
Maybe.
Well, have him on the show and have him tell him.
Okay.
Tell you
what we should get him on the phone right now. Well, Dr. Mary Frances Berry, it was great talking to you, and the book is My Face is Black is True, Callie House and the Struggle for Ex-Slave Reparations. Thanks for coming.
All right, thank
Doctor,
you.
Doctor, thank you so much.
Okay.
Very, very interesting conversation with Dr. Mary Frances Berry. Coming up next, we're going to talk about stress, battle stress, and the war in Iraq, and some warnings that the Bush administration had about some of the intelligence leading up to the war. Now, this is new stuff, folks. This is not some of the stuff that came from Shalaby or Curveball. This is some new fake intelligence information, and we'll have a roundup of various races across the country that voters will be dealing with tomorrow. Coming up next on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. It's 49 minutes past the hour.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Fifty-four minutes past the hour. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Barron will be back with us live in studio tomorrow. You know, we haven't talked much about the war in Iraq, and there are developments that are ongoing. In fact, there's an article in the London Times that was actually released yesterday that says, at least as far as the British are concerned, their troops are suffering from degrees of battle stress not experienced since the Second World War. Now, in this instance, it has to do with the fact that many of the British infantry that are over in Iraq are afraid of their criminal liability if they shoot anybody. And this has to do with some warnings that they had been given from the Royal Military Police that says that any incident where a British soldier uses his or her weapon will be thoroughly investigated. And the question then becomes, what happens to the soldiers who may have discharged their weapons in the fear of their lives or in a good faith effort to try and deal with some kind of insurgent problem? What happens to them? And it looks as though this level of battle stress has left more than 5,000 British troops, 5,370 to be exact, who decided to buy themselves out of the army in the past 3 years rather than go back to Iraq or go back to Afghanistan. A very looming problem in the United States as well, where recruitment levels are pretty much at an all-time low. Now, the other story that's coming out of Iraq is actually coming out of Washington, and it gets to the question of the extent to which the Bush administration knew what it was doing, even, when it invaded Iraq. We know already about the phony Niger documents. We know, for example, that there were no weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq. Now, there are reports that were released by Senator Carl Levin of Michigan that says that a top member of Al-Qaeda who was in American custody was identified as a likely fabricator some months before the Bush administration began to use the same guy's statements as the foundation for its claims that Iraq trained Al-Qaeda members to use biological and chemical weapons. These are declassified portions of a Defense Intelligence Agency document. You may remember the DIA. That's the intelligence arm that is totally under the control of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Some of you may remember this particular individual's name. His last name is Al Libby, and he is still in custody, by the way. Where he's being held is anybody's guess, because they don't tell you much after they finish using your intelligence, but apparently this guy's information was used more than once in speeches by Bush cabinet people to justify this notion that Al-Qaeda and Saddam had some kind of a connection, which most people said was impossible at the time. And now we see these documents being released that essentially says the Bush administration knew the guy was a liar before they used the intelligence information. That should make for some very interesting times at the Senate Intelligence Committee if they really do start to look into exactly what the administration knew and when it knew it on the road to war in Iraq. Coming up next, we're going to be talking with David Poland about the week's box office, and we're also going to talk about these races that are coming up tomorrow for you to go out and vote. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition, 57 past the hour. Minutes past the hour. Good morning. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with us live tomorrow morning, beginning at 6 o'clock Eastern. He was off Friday. He's off today. He will be back tomorrow. Let's say good morning to people who are working in container ports, wherever they may be. Let's say good morning to forklift operators, people who will rake leaves today. Let's say good morning to paralegals, to lawmakers trying to get answers. Let's say good morning to cigar smokers, and a special good morning to those who are trying to build affordable housing, wherever that may be. And finally, good morning to people who have resisted the urge to press the snooze button because they've got important work to do. That includes, of course, our good friend News Daddy, a.k.a. Wayne Gilman, because he had to do the important work of bringing the news this morning.
This is true. I try my best at that, Mr. Riley. Good morning to you and many of your listeners.
Good morning to you, sir.
Or the few who are still listening.
Oh, now that Mark is not here. Don't start no best, all right? You know, earlier this morning, we talked with senior analyst Christian Millard from France 3 TV about the latest developments going on in and around Paris. And, Wayne, this has spread way beyond Paris at this point.
Yeah, I think the Chirac government was not prepared for what was about to take place here. I guess this has been festering for quite some time. And, you know, the underpinning of this, there's a whole racial component to this, the fact that many of these people who are involved in the protest are people of African descent.
Yes, and very similar to what happens when there are uprisings here in the United States, this one, at least nominally, was brought on by a confrontation between young people and the police. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you go back over riots in America, going back to the Harlem riots of 1934, for example, you will find that there was, at its root, at its core, some misunderstanding, particularly between young people and the police. And we asked Christian Millard, because in this instance, it was a situation where two young people were electrocuted at a power station, and some of the young people in that suburban Paris neighborhood felt that the cops had literally chased them into this particular situation.
Right.
So we asked Christiane Millard whether it was that electrocution that actually was the catalyst for the violence we've seen thus far.
There is still a controversy about the truth, the way the two young kids were run after by the police or not. Officially, the justice prosecutor said no. But at the same time, other sources say yes. So it's a controversy. But let's put it this way. All this has been cooking up for months, for years. And it was just the way it was ignition of sparking the whole situation. We have to face to a lot of people who have never been integrated to French society. And this is one of the problems. We all fail in these countries to integrate these people who are French, as I said. And this is one of the toughest problems, the toughest situation we have ever faced in this country.
That's Christiane Millard, senior analyst with France 3 TV. We spoke to him a bit earlier this morning, Wayne. This is certainly, you don't want to see violence taking place anywhere. But there do seem to be some root problems that, by the way, Christiane Millard pointed out, both leftist and right-wing governments over the years have ignored.
Right, right. I find it particularly interesting because I've always looked at France as being a place, especially as an African-American, as a place that was probably far more tolerant of the whole racial divide thing as opposed to what would occur in this country. Many, many African-American nationals have left this country to take up residency in France.
In France, yeah.
To avoid some of the problems that they've encountered here.
Very
and
true.
To see this happening here like 40, 60 years later, after the first migratory move of African-American blacks to that country, you know, just seems to be somewhat startling.
Well, yeah, and there seems to be a question as to whether or not some of these young people are being influenced or egged on by Islamic fundamentalists,
mm-hmm.
yet you have the largest Islamic group in France issuing a fatwa against the violence.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be very clear about that. The Muslim community in France has, in fact, spoken out against the violence, but the fact is that many of the young men and women who are involved in this are Muslims. They
right.
come from North Africa, many of them, migrated to France over the long term. And, of course, there's also a pretty good number of people from African, sub-Saharan African francophone countries. In other
mm-hmm.
words, countries that were previously colonized by France. And many of these young men and women cannot find work.
Well, the thing is, though that situation is parallel to what goes on here. But one thing that the journalist just pointed out that has not been an effort made on the part of the government is perhaps to have some sort of integration or miscegenation process, if you will, you know, to perhaps bring about a French culture in which these people feel like as if they're part of what's going on.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and it does speak to the notion that you have to develop some kind of national identity. Now, I'm not talking about some kind of violent national identity, because that happens sometimes too, but a national identity that will at least bring together all the people who are living in your particular area or in your particular country.
Right.
Now,
at least.
Wayne Gilman, tomorrow is voting day.
Yeah.
Here in New York, over in New Jersey, in Virginia, in Detroit, in a referenda in both California and Ohio around redistricting. And by the way, I misspoke earlier this morning when I said that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in California was in favor of 8 initiatives. In fact, there are 8 on the ballot, and he is supporting 4 of them, which are not doing particularly well in the
yeah,
polls.
Yeah, he's been really stepping up his efforts to get 4 of them at least passed, and apparently has not been working in his favor, and it seems like it's almost like as if it's a referendum on his own ability to hold elective office, because there are many Californians now who are looking at his administration, what he's been able to do in the last 2 years, has it been? Or,
yeah.
And they're not really happy.
Are they ever happy?
Well,
they got rid of Gray Davis to put Arnold in. Now they're going to maybe they'll get rid of Arnold and put some. Well, are they just going to play Russian roulette with politicians till they find a governor they like?
Well, I think that's what it really boils down to. I mean, and speaking of gubernatorial contest, I know you're
familiar with what's
going on in New Jersey.
Yes.
I know we spoke about this Friday.
Yeah, it is a complete and utter mess.
It is.
Yeah.
And you know, I heard you on the way in here giving attribution to Cody, the acting
Governor,
Richard
yeah.
Cody,
Yeah.
And how his popularity suddenly soared.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, people were looking at him and they felt that he was trash, he was old, he had been in government too long, you know, and then all of a sudden now the tables have turned.
From trash to a breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
What a difference a few months and a different candidate will make.
Yeah.
No, he really, his approval ratings have skyrocketed mm-hmm. since he said he wasn't going to run for governor. I don't know that Dick Cody would have been involved in the kind of mudslinging. And I have to say, in fairness, I don't think John Corzine has actually slung any mud that we know about either.
Yeah,
I mean, that whole thing about Forrester having, this is the Republican candidate, having an affair was not something that the Corzine campaign had anything to do with, at least to hear them tell it.
Well, I find it interesting, and to Forrester's defense, that that came out after the issue with John Corzine's ex-wife.
Ex-wife, yeah.
Became a campaign issue during the course of the last
week. Well, it's mud for mud.
Well,
tit for tit.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's not taking them anywhere. And to me, I feel, if anything, Corzine should continue to take the high road at this point and just fly above that.
Well, he's only got 24 hours to worry about taking the high road because he'll be at the polls by tomorrow morning. But I saw the debate mm-hmm. on Saturday, the final debate between the two. Gabe Pressman, who we've known for the long term, was the moderator. And it was a very interesting, it was kind of like snake oil versus a college student kind of debate, because John Corzine was the college student. He seemed buried in his notes. He very rarely looked up.
Mm-hmm.
And Doug Forrester just looked like he was selling used cars to people.
Right.
I mean, at least that's the impression I got. My fear is that people will use the mud as an excuse to stay home.
I hope not.
I mean, the thing is,
there's been a ton of money spent. Certainly they've pulled out all the party stars, you know, on both parties, the Giulianis and the Clintons and people like that.
And Tom Kaine, of course, who was an icon.
Right, exactly. Just to shore up their respective bids, but there's no telling what the outcome will be at this point, because most polls are saying there's a slim lead, some polls are saying there's a 15% lead, and then some are saying that they're neck and neck, you know?
Well, so, no such quandaries here in New York, where every poll is 25% or higher in favor of the incumbent mayor, Michael Bloomberg.
I feel bad for Freddie Ferrer, but, you know, as the front page of the Amsterdam News, the Black Weekly in New York, said last week, miracles can happen.
Well, miracles can happen. My guess is they might not happen in this particular instance, but this speaks to a larger question for New York City Democrats, and that is the fact that they've been out of City Hall since 93.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now we're talking about going into a fourth consecutive term with a Republican as mayor.
I know.
Unprecedented in New York City history.
But I don't think it's going to turn the tide of New York being or New York State being a Democratic state. This man, according, if the New York Post is to be believed, has spent $118 per vote.
Yeah.
Michael Bloomberg.
Did you get yours?
No.
Did you get your $118?
Mr. Riley, you know, I barely get in here every day. Let alone spend $118 on me.
Hey, man, that's worth a parking violation in New York.
This is true.
Exactly. It's about the same amount of money.
Yeah, absolutely right.
But, it looks as though Mike Bloomberg is seen as the winner. Now, one race that's too close to call, apparently, is in Virginia, where you have two candidates, one Democrat, obviously one Republican.
Mm-hmm.
In Detroit, it's two Democratic candidates, President
Kilpatrick.
Kilpatrick and Hendricks,
mm-hmm.
who are running apparently neck and neck. And Kilpatrick, of course, Kwame Kilpatrick, the incumbent mayor, has somehow gotten the moniker the hip-hop mayor.
Yeah.
Apparently he took an earring out of his ear. He's not, I guess he's not playing Eminem when he walks into press conference.
I understand that he's gone through a metamorphosis of sorts, trying to change his image so he can shed himself of being considered the hip-hop mayor. Whether that works in his favor, we'll find out tomorrow.
We will definitely find out tomorrow. And Arnold Schwarzenegger may end up being, you know, really beaten about,
mm-hmm.
Politically speaking, that is, if these referenda that he's supporting, four of them, actually go down. And down to defeat, that is.
Well, I would like to think that if that should happen, that there's a sea change in the thinking of most residents in the state of California, that you don't no longer have to elect someone from a Hollywood background. Because, I mean, there are other contenders out there who are considering vying for the job. But, you know, I think that we should go to the point where we have traditional politicians running for elective office who are familiar with the issues and not going into a contest based on their previous experience and their popularity as being an actor or an actress.
But, you know, we've had an awful lot of them. But let me see.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've
had Sonny Bono, the late Sonny Bono, who was elected to office. Clint Eastwood was the mayor of Carmel by the Sea, I believe it is, in California. You've had, obviously, Ronald Reagan, who became president of the United States. Why shouldn't actors run?
I'm not, you know, the thing is that I think... You know, I have an issue with that the same way I have an issue, and of course this goes into broadcasting here, where you have people who are not seasoned or traditional broadcasters getting into the business carrying their name just predicated on what they've done in other forms of media.
Who are you talking about, Wayne?
I don't want to call names right now, you know? I mean,
we'd extend
this another hour if I were to get into
names.
That. You know?
Maybe we'll go through a commercial break and come back and Wayne can name names. No, wait a minute. Thanks
a lot.
Set
me up.
No,
yeah, thank
I'm
you.
Not setting you up. Right. Thanks a lot for being with us, man. Much appreciated.
Yeah, I gathered.
We're going to come back. We're going to talk later on, actually not later on, in the next little while, about the box office this past weekend and about a very weird story about some kids who went to see one movie and got to see something very, very different. Stay with us. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio, 19 minutes past the hour.
Break in, nothing to lose. Makes you laugh at the troubling news. Sometimes I wonder if he's hitting the booze. Al Franken,
King of the Jews.
Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with us tomorrow. And remember, you can email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com and you can podcast Morning Sedition. Take it with you in your MP3 player. Go to morningsedition.com for further details. T.O., 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 out, out, out. And that he is. T.O., by the way, is, for those of you who don't follow football, a very talented wide receiver by the name of Terrell Owens. He is talented. He is just as controversial as he is talented. He has been suspended indefinitely by his team, the Philadelphia Eagles, after a tumultuous week last week, that led to an apparent fist fight between Terrell Owens and former teammate Hugh Douglas, who has become an ambassador for the Philadelphia Eagles football team. Last night, Hugh Douglas said that there were no punches landed. He wouldn't discuss further details. Owens was not with Philadelphia when they went to the Washington Redskins home base in Landover, Maryland last night, and the Eagles lost that game 17-10. I don't know if that means T.O.'s suspension, which is now indefinite, will only last that one particular game. There's some question as to whether or not he's still going to end up playing with the Eagles when this is all said and done. He has long been upset about the terms of his contract, a contract, we have to say in fairness, that he signed. But the fact of the matter is, he's only making like 3.5 from what I saw in one recent report. And for a guy of his talent, that's not a whole bunch of money. But you know what? You make your bed, you lie in it until the contract is up. Or you go and try and change the structure of the National Football League's contract situation, which many people, I think, feel favors management as opposed to the players. But, T.O., man, you got to do better than this. You've got to do better than this. Now, here in New York, and this could, I guess, only happen in New York, there's Times Square Movie Theater, the AMC Empire 25 Theater in Midtown. It's right on 42nd Street. And they were supposed to be showing the movie Chicken Little. Now, that is a G-rated animated film. Instead, what they got was a film called Andrea, a Spanish drama during which a kid hangs himself in the middle. Now, the kids that were in the audience who were expecting to see a nice little kid-friendly film instead saw a kid commit suicide. Many of the parents involved were very, very upset about this, obviously speaking. And, of course, they ended up, patrons who went to that film and saw the suicide actually got tickets for another film. I don't know what are they going to do, Scary Movie 4 or something? I don't know what they're going to end up seeing. But they did get a little perk from the theater for what was very obviously a stupid mistake by the theater. We're going to find out exactly how Chicken Little did in the box office wars this past weekend. I don't know if Andrea, the Spanish drama, actually is going to be in this week's report, but we're going to be talking with our good friend David Poland, editor of Movie City News and columnist of The Hot Button. He's going to tell us what's hot and what's not in film land. Stay with us. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with us live in studio tomorrow. Right now, with the latest on what's going on in Hollywood, we're pleased to welcome back our regular guest, the editor of Movie City News and the creator of thehotbutton.com. David Poland is on the phone with us from the West Coast. Good morning, David. How you doing?
Good morning, Mark. Apparently, I scared Mark away.
Yeah, you sure did. But he'll be back tomorrow. He'll be back next week. Don't worry.
Goodness.
Now, David, I got to ask you right off the top. We saw something really weird happen here in New York, where some kids went to see Chicken Little, and they ended up seeing something called Andrea, where a kid committed suicide. What would you do if you had a kid in an audience and something like that happened?
Well, I don't, there's not a lot you can do. I mean, obviously, nobody did it on purpose. It's just things like that happen now and again. Also, the great stories about people buying videos with, you know, kids' cartoons in them and turning out with pornography. You know, education is education.
Have you heard about this movie, Andrea, at all?
No. I mean, I heard the story that they had seen this suicide.
Yeah.
But I haven't heard a lot about the movie specifically, no.
Just curious. Now, we see in the box office this
probably
week,
the best publicity they've ever gotten, they'll ever get.
I would imagine, yeah. I guess they might have a widescreen rollout now or something. I don't know. But Chicken Little did well. It was the number one movie at the box office this past weekend. Grossed $40 million. Good draw, huh?
Yeah, it's a good draw. It's not overwhelming. It's kind of a solid number, but it's not really the kind of number that Pixar has done, which some people were thinking out here. But, you know, it's the kind of weird thing now where everybody's expectations are so enormous that success is not enough. It has to be overwhelming. But Disney actually did a very good job over the weekend of managing expectations.
Really? What did they do?
Well, they started actually talking to media over the weekend before they even got to the Sunday number about the fact that they were happy with the number and they didn't feel they had to do a Pixar number, and which is really more like $70 million for something like The Incredibles last year. So they, you know, they actually got, oh, we don't mind the bad reviews, oh, we don't mind the number, everything's okay.
Now, Pixar and Disney were in bed, were they not?
They still are.
They still are,
I think
okay.
They're coming out next summer, and it seems very likely that Pixar will re-sign with Disney. So that deal, there's been speculation that somehow Chicken Little's box office would affect the deal with Disney.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is, I don't think it really has much of anything to do with it, except for who could be a little more cocky during the negotiations.
So Pixar is going to re-up, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, the best marketer for children's movies by far is Disney. It is their primary business. And a couple of years ago, even before Michael Eisner left, they kind of decided they were going to go primarily into the family business. So that's why you see so many of these small films, like The Greatest Game Ever Played, which very few people ended up seeing, but is a family drama about a golf game from 1937 or whatever.
Oh, okay.
They're in the smaller, they're not spending as much money, and they're making movies that are for families because it's what they do best. That's their core business.
Mm-hmm. David Poland, Jarhead finished second, 28.7. Good number for them?
An incredible number for them, considering the, you know, mostly not so great reviews. You know, a lot of people were kind of surprised by what this movie was, and particularly compared to the trailer. I mean, the great line of the weekend was, whatever they paid for that Kanye West song was worth the money.
Now, wait a minute. Let's explain for our audience what you mean by this. In other words, people saw the trailers, the ads on TV, and they thought this was going to be one kind of movie, more hip-hop-ish, perhaps?
Well, more of a kind of worry, action, you know, go-go-go kind of movie about, you know, that has some irony, a lot more like Three Kings than it actually was.
Uh-huh. And instead they got what?
They got a very dry, kind of Godot-ish movie about people waiting around in the desert, masturbating a lot. I can say that on Air America, can I?
Sure, you just did.
Yeah, it's a heavy, well, there you go. Yeah, it's a lot of standing around in the desert waiting to go somewhere and not going anywhere very quickly and worrying about whether their girlfriends are having sex with other people. So
now, David, does that mean, I mean, if people go to see a movie on an initial weekend and it turns out not to be what they expect, doesn't that kind of presage a big drop-off in box office next weekend?
Almost inevitably. It depends a lot on the marketplace and, you know, and what you consider a big drop-off. If this picture does a 40% drop, that'll be considered successful week to week.
Hmm.
On the other hand, if it were going to be a big movie, if people were expecting it to do a lot of business or that it was very popular or people were completely satisfied with it, you would hope for a 25% drop going into next weekend when you would have not a whole lot of competition right now in this marketplace.
It doesn't seem that way, David. I'm looking at the top 12 films over this past weekend.
Yeah.
None of them have grossed $100 million yet, at least in terms of domestic box office. But I know you're one of the people who believes that really doesn't matter as much as it used to. Why not?
Hitting $100 million doesn't matter as much as it used to?
Yeah, at least in domestic box office.
Well, the domestic market, I mean, it matters, but it's different. I mean, ultimately, we've had more $100 million movies this year than we had last year. Or actually more movies that have done over $130 million this year than we had last year. But we are in a lull period for the fall. But ultimately, the box office is now about 25 to 35% domestic revenue, and then you have foreign box office doing actually more as a rule than the American box office, and then DVD is worth even more than either one of those two markets. So.
Yeah, DVD sales sales and rentals, I guess, are worth more than domestic box office, more than overseas box office.
Yeah, it's roughly 40%. That's roughly 40% of your income now.
Hmm.
On average movies. Yeah.
Now, David, what kinds of films? What genres do best overseas? What genres do best going over to DVD?
Well, the films that don't do business overseas are comedies where there are a lot of words. So if somebody falls on their face a lot, like somebody like Jim Carrey, it can do well overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, comedies don't translate as well. And a lot of the kids' movies don't translate as well, though some of them, something like Finding Nemo, did huge numbers overseas. But anything that's really too very American, quote-unquote, tends not to play as well overseas. But things that are, it's one of the reasons why action movies are so very popular for the studios and so successful is because they do huge numbers overseas because the action is the primary thing.
Now, David, if we look at, for example, The Legend of Zorro, which has done 30 mil up until now in 2 weeks,
yeah.
That is the kind of action movie that will do well overseas, in your judgment?
Well, it's done better overseas than it's done here, which Sony has very, you know, pointedly pointed out each weekend. But that's been true. I mean, Warner Brothers, there's a big story about Warner Brothers in the New York Times this weekend. Warner Brothers has actually become the specialist in doing huge numbers overseas, even when films don't do that well here. A movie like Troy, which was considered a bit of a disappointment here last summer, did four times overseas what it did here.
Four times?
Yeah. So that movie ended up being like a $550 million movie worldwide.
Is that Brad Pitt? Is that the Brad Pitt effect or something?
It's the Brad Pitt effect combined in that case with the sword and sandals and everything else. But Warner Brothers has become very, very effective in selling their movies overseas, even when the movies don't do that much here. Same thing was true with Last Samurai. It's really this Warner Brothers strength. So a lot of the movies they make, people kind of question whether the domestic box office is big enough, but ultimately it's doing huge numbers overseas. And yes, Brad Pitt, much bigger star in Europe and the rest of the world than he is here.
Okay, David Paul.
Leo DiCaprio, too, by the way.
Oh, really?
Much
Him,
bigger.
Too. Okay. David Poland, I know that you get to see a lot of films before the rest of us do.
Whether I like it or not.
Yeah, right. Now, you've seen the film version of the Broadway stage hit Rent. What'd you think?
I saw all 3,229.43 minutes of the movie.
Wow.
I'm not a huge Rent. I had not seen Rent on Broadway. I was not a Rent head. And I've gotten many emails this weekend because I wrote about the film, and I called them Renties, and I got many, "You're so ignorant. We're called Rent heads, not Renties." I'm like, great, okay. They're very, very sensitive, the people who love Rent, but not a big fan of the picture.
Not a big fan of the picture. Now,
not a big fan of the picture.
What happens if you post something that says, "I'm not a big fan of the picture"? Who calls you?
Oh, I get calls from a lot of people. I mean, the Rent review was pretty tough, and so there were a few people upset at a few studios. People get, you know, very nervous this time of year, and a picture like this is, you know, expensive, and they're hoping to figure out how to break beyond the Renties or the Rent heads or whatever they want to call themselves. So they're very sensitive, and usually what happens is by being one of the first people to write about a picture, the sting is that much greater. Last year there was a picture that was around this time of year that, you know, was involving major talent and everything else. I wrote about it, and after I didn't write about it for a couple of weeks and wrote about it 3 days before it opened, and the studio called the morning I wrote about it and said, "Oh, we're going to ban you. You're never going to see one of our pictures again." I'm like, "What are you talking about?"
Now, see, it's funny. I was going to ask you about that, but what picture was this that you're talking about?
I shouldn't say.
Why not? You wrote about it, didn't you?
They're so sensitive, these guys.
Well, let's talk about that for a quick second in the time we have left.
They might be involved in the movie Rent, probably not.
Uh-oh. Do studios and or publicists regularly threaten your access when you write something bad early or write something that they feel is going to cost them box office?
Well, it changes. It evolves. The more they consider you, quote-unquote, powerful, the more difficult it is for them to play that game. So if you're the New York Times, you can pretty much write about somebody having sex with their sister, even if it's not true, and they'll keep on inviting you and asking you to do stories and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Being an internet journalist for the last decade, there were times early on when there was more of a regular threat. Now it's people are less likely because they want you to do the positive stuff also. After years of dealing with somebody like myself, they understand that when I like something, I'll really support it, and if I hate something, I'll really try to kill it. So they take the good with the bad, and ultimately getting the good is more valuable than what they worry about with the bad.
David, and maybe you can enlighten me on this because I don't go to the movies that often. When was the last time there was a movie you can remember that did better box office in its second or third week than it did in its initial weekend of release?
It's pretty rare. I mean, the only time you see that is when you see a picture like Good Night and Good Luck or Capote or Shop Girl right now that are, you know, going out in short, in small bursts. So,
how about The Wedding Crashers? Did that do better second week out or so?
No.
But
Wedding Crashers had very, very small drops. Wedding Crashers is a picture that did, you know, 8% off on a weekend, which is also extremely rare these days. But no, it didn't go up, but it did go, I mean, it went up.
Slowly down.
It wasn't 4th of July weekend, but if it's a holiday weekend or something like that comes up, that happens. But in terms of normal box office, no, it didn't go up. But the studio was absolutely shocked that Wedding Crashers held as strongly as it did, considering it was an R-rated comedy, and then you had European Gigolo came into the business, and so did 40-Year-Old Virgin, which did $100 million. So that movie held extraordinary. $200 million for Wedding Crasher, I think, stunned everybody at New Line.
All right. David Poland, as always, great to talk with you, man. Thanks a lot for being with us.
And good luck finding your other Mark.
Don't worry. He'll be back tomorrow. Take care.
Take care.
David Poland from Movie City News and The Hot Button. We're going to be back to wrap all this up for this morning. Stay with us. It's 47 minutes past the hour, Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Now, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Fifty-one minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. We're going to wrap and tie this thing for a Monday morning. And as we've been telling you all morning, the violence in suburban France has spread. It has continued to spread throughout the weekend. More than 3,300 vehicles have been destroyed. And this violence began October 27th. We're now at November 7th, and still it rages on. In fact, it has now spread to cities like Toulouse and Marseille and the resort towns of Cannes and Nice in the south, Lille in the north, and Strasbourg to the east. The government, whether that be Prime Minister de Villepin or President Chirac, are trying to get a handle on this, trying to get a handle on how they best deal with this violence. And we will be keeping you updated on a daily basis as to what's going on in and around the suburbs of Paris. Tomorrow, of course, Election Day, with an awful lot at stake in New York City, a lot at stake in New Jersey, a lot at stake in Detroit, a lot at stake in Virginia, and a lot at stake in both California and Ohio, where there are ballot initiatives that people will have the opportunity to vote for. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is supporting 4 out of the 8 ballot initiatives. And, of course, the state of California is one of those places where ballot initiatives are often used to do an end around the elected legislature of the state. I don't know why they do that. You know, you elect a group of people to make laws for you, and then, you know, the minute you have a problem with the law, you have some kind of a ballot initiative to change the law. Well, that's in fact what seems to be going on here. Arnold Schwarzenegger promises to fix the broken system. His initiatives, the initiatives that he is supporting, would create some problems for organized labor. It would grant him the power to cut the state's budget unilaterally. That's all by himself. And, you know, there are people that are looking for some level of relief in terms of taxes, in terms of many of the issues that people in, by the way, states all over America have a problem with. He also is looking to change how California draws its district lines, taking it out of the Democratic-controlled legislature and giving it to a panel of retired judges. In Ohio, it's interesting, they are trying to take power from a Republican-controlled board of elected officials in favor of a bipartisan citizens commission. So you see that in many instances, these kinds of reforms can cut both ways. Here in New York, everybody's expecting the incumbent mayor, Michael Bloomberg, to win the election by 30 points or more. I doubt it seriously against the Democrat Fernando Ferrer. And New Yorkers may be waking up Tuesday morning, first of all, to apparently pretty decent weather in terms of going out and voting. But they may be wake up Wednesday morning, after all the ballots are counted, with a fourth term Republican mayor. Rudy Giuliani served for 2 terms. If Mike Bloomberg wins tomorrow, he will have served 2 terms. That is 4 terms, 16 years of Republican rule in a city that is 4-1 Democratic. So the main thing, no matter how you feel about Mike Bloomberg or Fernando Ferrer, there is a conservative candidate, Tom Ognebeni, a former city councilman running a race. Whoever you want to support, the important part is to come out and support them. And we also want to talk, of course, about New Jersey, where John Corzine, senator, is battling Doug Forrester, the Republican candidate. A whole bunch of mud has been slung. We don't need to sling any more of it here. The important part is that people in New Jersey get out and vote. We have a mayor's race in Detroit, where Kwame Kilpatrick is running against Freeman Hendricks. And, of course, Freeman Hendricks won the August primary, but Kilpatrick, who is the incumbent, who's only 35 years old, by the way, apologized to the city of Detroit for any excesses. You know, the Source magazine once described him as the player mayor, because apparently he spent a whole bunch of money, $210,000 on his city MasterCard during his first 3 years, including $946 at a nightclub in Washington, D.C., and a Las Vegas spa, and had an 18-member security force during a time of layoffs. So it's going to be interesting to see whether or not Detroit residents choose reform in that regard, or whether they think there's really not that much difference between Mr. Hendricks and Mayor Kilpatrick. In Virginia, it's a really, really tight race between Timothy Kaine, the Democratic nominee, and Jerry Kilgore. And, of course, Timothy Kaine is the current lieutenant governor seeking to replace fellow Democrat Mark Warner, who has been term limited out. They're rallying all over the state of Virginia, which is not an easy thing to do. Virginia is a pretty good-sized state. They are rallying throughout the state. And interestingly enough, going to the others' strong suits, to their home turf, to try and seek out votes. And they're seeking to try and replicate the 71% voter turnout that Virginia experienced in the 2001 presidential election, as against, I believe it was something on the order of 46% who voted the last time for governor. So that's pretty much what's going on in those races. Please get out and vote tomorrow. Think all day if you would, and if you can help those people who've been devastated by that tornado that ripped through Indiana and Kentucky. It cost 22 people their lives. We'll be back tomorrow live with Mark Maron. Have yourselves a great day. Air America Radio.